14th in the year 2000, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing R.D. Smith at his home at 200 Caldwell Street in Chapel Hill. Good morning, R.D.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Oh, good. I'm doing fine.
Good. First of all, I really enjoyed the interview with you yesterday, and I thank you for sharing all those things with me.
Well, it was nice. Really nice. I enjoyed it myself.
I wanted to focus today on the events leading up to the integration of the high school and the actual integration and subsequent problems and the solutions to those problems, if there were solutions. And the first question I want to ask you is, what actions were there in the black community to have the high school integrated, or to have the schools in general integrated?
Well, it wasn't necessarily the schools alone. As an outgrowth of the city in Greensboro by A&T College students, it began to spread throughout the country, not only for integration of facilities, but it went into the schools and businesses and everywhere else. So it was just a carryover from that particular incident in which various elements in the community and in the nation decided, well, if we're going to integrate the rest of them in the eating places, why not integrate everything? So it began to just take hold throughout the country. And Chapel Hill is no exception. We had some people who, because of the university being located here, you have all various types of attitudes from people all over the country, you know, because students come from all over the country, and they come from areas where they've gone to school with blacks, and they've associated with blacks over the years. I mean, probably all their lifetime, and they have good friends in black who are black. So it was natural that it would be, if you're going to start somewhere, it would start in Chapel Hill, they say. Anything that's worth going on happens in Chapel Hill first. So, and then, as I said before, we had some adults in the community who had very liberal attitudes, and as a result, they began to wonder and to push for certain changes in society that had been existed too long, as far as they were concerned.
Were there committees that were formed regarding the integration of the schools, or were these issues that were discussed church or fraternal organizations?
Well, I guess it was probably discussed in throughout the community, the various organizations, churches, and the same, because a lot of it is not growth of church leadership. But no one particular, I'd say, segment. It was no particular committee, other than maybe it was discussed in before the school board and that type of thing by various organizations and individuals.
So organizations went to the school board?
It's my opinion that they did, see.
Did the school board have black representation?
At that time, no. They did not have black representation. Well, they did, too, because Reverend Manley, I believe, was on the school board during that time.
Mm-hmm. Was he a good advocate for integration?
Well, I don't know, because I didn't attend the school board, and I didn't know how he reacted to it. But being in the being an Afro-American himself, I can imagine that he didn't object to it, put it that way.
Did you feel that there was a really strong support in the black community for integration? Or were there factions where people said, hey, it's always been this way, let's not change it, we're going to rile up the whites?
No, I don't think because they had a choice. They had a freedom of choice thing. And then those who wanted to participate did so by sending their children, enrolling their children in white school. Those who didn't. There wasn't so much either for or against, but as I said yesterday, the pride that Afro-Americans had in their own schools was a thing that was, I think, the strongest that kept the school going. Because there was a tremendous amount of pride in the community, both by students and by parents. Because of the record, because of the activities that went on, the school was like the church. It was the center of activities in the black community. And they didn't want necessarily to disband that pride. Eventually, of course, they probably realized that eventually there'd be some changes because of the activities that were going on in the community as far as integration is concerned.
That's a really strong statement, that the school was like the church, that it was the center of activity.
Oh, it was. Oh, yeah, it was. It was really, it was the center of activity. Things that happened, when I say center of activity, because every activity that was held at the school, there was tremendous parental support. Football, basketball, band concert, May Day, all kind of activities that happened at that black school. As I said yesterday, the parents bought the first activity bus that we had in Lincoln. So, you know, that says something about the community support that the school had, and the fact that a large number of the parents were graduates of either Orange County Training School or Lincoln, to a great extent. So, you know, it's just like any of us who graduate from college, we have a great allegiance to that institution. See, when we support that, whatever they do. I had my twin daughters and my son. My twin daughters went to A&T, my son went to Hampton, and they traveled to Virginia this weekend for a football game because of that, you know, allegiance to the two schools, and had a good time. And you know, we support our colleges with financial aid, finance, and everything else because of that.
What kind of cooperation was there between the black community and the white community in the formation of the new high school, the Chapel Hill High School?
I'm not familiar with any type of cooperation between the two groups. All I know is once they decided that rather than in the process of integrating the schools, rather than having one group say, this is my school and you're coming to my school, they built another school, built the high school out in the country, which said it would be our school. Mm-hmm. Nobody could say that the blacks are coming to Chapel Hill High School, which would be on Franklin Street, because it wasn't in reverse, wasn't happening in reverse. No whites was going to Lincoln. So in order to keep that from being a contention, they decided to build an altogether different school because really they didn't have adequate space up where they were, and they had a good offer to buy that property from business people. So they said, well, let's just, they went out here in the country and they bought about 100 acres of land. 50 acres of that was black person's land. So, you know, that's been that way. Nobody could say, you know, the blacks are coming to my school, our school, or the whites are coming to our school. So it wasn't an issue, really, I don't think.
Now,
because of that,
the federal integration laws were passed, I believe, in 1964. Mm-hmm. And was that the law that then allowed the blacks to attend any school, a white school?
Well, that was the interpretation, of course, of the law was that we will give you the freedom of choice thing. Mm-hmm. You can, if you wish. You don't have to, but you can if you wish. So as I said, a few black parents took advantage of that to test the law, I think, to see from the standpoint of Chapel Hill. You know, Chapel Hill has this reputation of liberal, being liberal, and we just say, well, let's see how liberal we are in Chapel Hill. So as a result, several of men in elementary school, several to the high school, and the Vickersburg young man, Hines, who was an outstanding football player for Lincoln, played in for Lincoln, enrolled into Chapel Hill High School. And of course, that one of the parents of one of the white athletes was so impressed with Hines and his ability to play football, they asked Mr. Pillman, you know, to train their son to play in, because Pillman was the coach at Lincoln.
At Lincoln.
Yeah, and Hines was an outstanding athlete on Lincoln's team. And he ended up being an outstanding athlete on Chapel Hill High School's team. Of course, he's now, he was in the health department in Sanford. Eugene Hines. I don't think he's retired yet. I saw him not long ago. I don't believe he's retired, but he's probably eligible for retirement.
What kind of experience did those students, the few black students who integrated the high school on Franklin Street, have? Do you have any idea?
I have no idea. Well, I have no idea because from what I can, what I know, they didn't have problems. Didn't have many problems. You know, naturally there would be somebody who would resent, et cetera. But as far as physical activities and those type of things, they didn't have anything like that. But naturally, being the first to integrate a school, to go to a white school, predominantly white school, you have some people who resent that type of thing.
So the integrated high school opened in 67, is that correct?
The present integrated high school?
Yes.
66, fall of 66.
Fall of 66.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And were the plans to make it integrated at opening?
Oh, yeah.
Or were they to make it white for a while and then have the black?
Well, at one time they had thought that they had said that they would open the school, and then when the enrollment at Lincoln got to a certain point, then they would send the Afro-American kids to the new high school. But that ended up with bitter resistance on the part of the black people.
Tell me more about that.
Well, they said, but if you're going to integrate, then in order to keep our kids from feeling that they're going to the white school, let's send every child to the school at the same time, and then it will be their school. It won't be our school, it will be their school. So the school board agreed that that would be, I think, the best procedure to follow, and would have probably least amount of problems, because judging from what was happening all over the country in the integration process, in my opinion, that they felt that might alleviate some of the problems, just like they did for the mascot and the colors when the students decided that over summer break. That was because one of the things that you heard most of when they were integrating schools was they would always take the mascot and the colors of the white school, which mean the black school was losing part of its identity. But the students said, no, we're going to take the color of one school and the mascot of the other school at the new high school. That is the way the school board accepted it.
Where were the discussions among the black community taking place to keep the school from being all white when it opened?
Well, it was taken primarily in front of the school board.
And who represented your community?
Oh, well, I don't remember right offhand who was represented at that time, but most of it was taking place there. And of course, you know, you had organizations in the community that I'm sure they discussed it in their regular meetings sometime, you know. A lot of times the churches try to stay clear of what they call the church and state, you know, that philosophy. Yeah. they try not to mix it. Some churches do, you know. Of course, some churches didn't. See? But to some extent, that was a philosophy of some churches during that integrating process.
In the planning for the new high school, did you feel as though the black community was consulted adequately regarding integration and any problems that might occur in the new school?
Being a teacher, I was not privileged to be in on any type of conversation of that nature. I'm not sure. There might have been some discussion, but as a teacher, I was not privileged, was not a part of any discussion. So I can imagine because of the sensitivity of the integrating process and the effect it would have on the black community and the black school, I imagine that there were some discussions somewhere with the school board or somewhere in the community.
You had mentioned that there was a committee that was formed of students to decide on school colors and mascots and so forth.
Well, I think that was a thing that maybe some parents had discussed it with the school board, and in an effort to try to alleviate some of the problems that they had heard about or seen in other school systems. The school board probably realized that if we're going to integrate, we want to try to alleviate some of those problems if we can. And that was one of the ones that they probably said, let the students decide. Why should we decide? Let the students decide. And then, of course, there again, it would be one of the things that would not be on their shoulder and on their minds. You know, well, they had a way out by saying the students decided that. We didn't. The students decided that. It just so happened that there were black students and white students on the committee, and they agreed. They could agree because, believe it or not, to a great extent, a large number of the black students and white students were familiar with each other. See, especially in a small town like this, you know. Chapel Hill was a small community back in those days. The city limits were so close to the center of town, you wouldn't believe it, you know. But since that time, Chapel Hill has grown.
I think that during that 10-year period, there was a doubling of the town.
I'm sure there was. Yeah, I'm sure there was. Because I would happen to have been on the planning board during that time, and then later on the 67 on the Board of Aldermen, and the number of special use permits that we granted for apartments in this town was tremendous. It just expanded, like it just bloated. Well, the university stopped building to a great extent dormitories. They slacked off of building dormitory, but they increased the enrollment of the student body, which meant that they had to stay somewhere. So the business people took advantage of that. They said, oh, that's why one of the Granville Towers is built up there, close to the university. It's for our students. And that's all who lives in that building, so students, see. they can walk to campus, walk back all the time, and are close into town. That's why we're having such a problem right now in the black community, because people are building houses primarily for the student population, and students are moving in. You can see that over here, but it's close to campus. See, they don't have any, they're taking all the parking spaces on campus and converting them to a building, which means they don't have any place to park cars, so they're sending a building out in the community.
It's interesting, you have white students primarily moving into the black community.
Oh, sure. That's right. That's exactly. We have on each end of this street, down on that end, on the right side, of Afro-American built apartments. And all of them are occupied by white students. On this end, the same man built the apartments up there. They're occupied by students, all of them. And right next door to me are white workers and white students. But we can say one thing. We don't know they're there, necessarily. They aren't rowdy and noisy and, you know, disruptive and everything. They have their parties over there next door to me, right there. And they'll put up black plastic and they'll solve all the noise that they might make, even talking, because they don't have loud outdoor music over there. But they are conscious of the fact that their presence cannot be disruptive. Mr. Aidcar will live right across the street from him. See? He has apartments back here in the back, and a lot of white students are in those apartments that he owns. But his daddy left when he was living. And of course they become the property of Ed once their parents die. Okay.
Well, let's go back to the high school integration again. What I hear you saying is that there was sensitivity to the integration process in both the black community and the white community. Is that fair to say?
I think that's a fair statement. There was a great sensitivity as far as this integration of the school is concerned, because there was a concern about losing, it's a particular the black school, losing their identity, being wrapped up in the white culture, and losing all of the identity of the things that the Afro-Americans held precious, which means their schools. They put a lot of effort and things into the development of their schools and school programs. And the teachers, of course, had put a lot of effort into the school system and training the young people that went to Lincoln. So that sensitivity was there. Now, I don't know how much sensitivity there was in the white schools about moving, about the integrating process, but as far as the black people are concerned, they were sensitive to a lot of the things that possibly could happen. And another one of the things, of course, was this matter of colors and mascots. There would no longer be a Lincoln Tiger, see, which was really a thing that the whole community was proud of. Not only the black community, a tremendous number of white students from the university and the town attended Lincoln's football games.
They were that good.
They were that good.
And their band?
And their band was
that
from
good.
When they'd parade, there'd be a showpiece. The chorus, the drama club, basketball team. I mean, there was outstanding students at Lincoln High School that we were proud of. As teachers, we were proud of, because we had a feeling that we had been a part of those youngsters' development, and the students had shown their appreciation by the love and affection that they had given to the faculty and support.
Speaking of the faculty, who decided on what teachers would teach at Chapel Hill High School?
Mr. McDougal, Charles A. McDougal, principal, he selected the faculty.
Just like a whole new high school.
Oh, no, new high school.
Yes.
No, well, at that time, the principal of the school, which was May Marshbanks, was a principal. So she was a principal up at the Chapel Hill High School on Franklin Street. And she and Mr. McDougal, Mr. McDougal became the assistant principal at the new high school. He was principal, of course, of the black school. And between there, the two of them, they decided on the faculty, along with, of course, the school board, because they had said a certain number of black teachers would go to the high school, the new high school, and a certain number of whites would go, teachers from the two schools, based on the curriculum, I guess it was. And then they spread out the black teachers in the other areas of, because see, we had 7 through 12, through 11, elementary school and all, where they didn't at the high school. So they were strictly high school. And they had 8, 9 through 11. But at Lincoln, it was 7 through 12, 7 through 11. So those teachers, it had to be absorbed somewhere in the system.
Did the white high school have 9 through 11 or 9
no.
through 12?
No, it had 9 through 11 when they opened up.
9 through 11.
Yeah.
What? How comparable were the populations in the two schools of, in the 9 to 11th grade area, so far as the numbers were concerned?
Oh, they were about one-third, two-thirds.
Uh-huh. Right. Just like the population?
Yeah, about the population of Chapel Hill.
And how many black teachers were there who were appointed to be on the faculty at the new Chapel Hill High?
Oh, whoa. Let's see, me, Ms. Pope, Ms. Clemens, Coach. I'd say that there were about 6 out of about a third of the faculty there when it opened.
So it was representative.
It was about representative. I think the school board was conscious of the fact that they wanted the faculty to be representative of the population. There were 6 or 7. Black teachers that went to high school.
Once the school was integrated, what did you see that the problems were at the new high school?
Well, at the new high school, one of the problems, of course, was the fact that that the students had no courses or no courses in black history. That was one of their grievances. We want black history courses taught. Another problem was the fact that the students felt that the white teachers really didn't care by their action and things like that, because they had come from a school in which the teachers were concerned not only with their academic achievement, but they were concerned with the education of the whole child and talking about the problems that youth has. You see, it alarms me sometimes when they talk about children first. Now, what do they mean when they say children first? What do they mean when they say we're going to give students the best education possible? In my opinion, education means more than and then academics. How to live, how to get along with people, how to develop certain characteristics, honesty and integrity and
value system
that you don't get necessarily in academics when you're stressing academics alone. And that's a part of students living.
And did you
students growth.
Did you feel that was given at Lincoln High School?
Oh, yes.
Was it given at the new high school?
That's one of the problems because the new high school was concentrating strictly on academics. And that set up a large number of problems. See, we in the black community, we were so close to the students and the families that we knew. See, we were required to visit. We were required to visit the homes of every student and make a report to the principal of our findings. So we knew some of the problems that students were having, that the parent-student relationship, that we could work on in the schools. We didn't have to necessarily get out and publicize it, but we knew if a student was having problems at home, that would be affected in that student's performance.
So you visited each student's home?
In our homeroom. In our homeroom. No, in our homeroom.
In your homeroom.
In our homerooms. Of course, I visited every home, the home of every student in my classes, because I was an ag teacher and I was required by law to visit every home. See, that was a part of agriculture, of teaching the agriculture course to farm boys. Most of my young men were in the country. So I had to visit them and set up projects with them and their families. That was a requirement by the state and federal government.
But the other teachers, the parents came to the school and visited the homeroom?
No, the teachers visited the home.
The teachers visited the students' home?
Students' home, that's right.
That's quite a commitment.
Well, it was. It was a commitment. That was one of the things that Mr. McDougall required of every one of his teachers.
And that's
you visit the students' home and get to know the parents, get to know the situation in a child's home. That way you are in a better position to teach that child. You'll be in a better position then when you have parent-teacher conference to talk with the parent about certain things, like a lack of study facilities in that home, you know, and those type of things.
Now, did that practice continue at the new high school?
No. That practice ended at the new high school. So you can understand the allegiance and the support and the whatever you want to call it, that relationships between the faculty at Lincoln and the parents in the community, the homes in the community, and why we had such tremendous support from the parents for our school program.
It was a school to die for. What you're describing is just really an awesome kind of relationship between the teachers and the students and the parents.
Yeah, and then of course, we as teachers, we went to church where the parents were attending church too. I mean, you know, we met them on the streets. We met them in church. We met them in school. We discussed with them, talked with them. I knew almost every parent in Tyler Chapel Hill, a black parent in Tyler Chapel Hill, as well as most of them out in the country.
So here you have this rich heritage being taken away from the black students.
And the black parents.
And the black parents.
Oh, yeah. Because the parents didn't attend PTA meeting as well at the new high school as they did with Lincoln.
Why
they had a... You must remember you have a group of parents in this community who were highly educated, and they feel like that they make decisions over coffee somewhere, you know? They make decisions in the clubs that they have, as far as the operation of the schools are concerned, and those type of things where the black parents were not as highly educated, and they weren't likely to be as outspoken. And to some extent, they didn't feel welcome at PTA meetings because of that.
Did they feel that the decisions were already made?
To a great extent. They're made as far as what's going to happen is already made when they come to meeting.
Did that ever end, that feeling, do you think?
I don't think it's ended completely, no. I really don't, because first of all, they changed philosophy, they changed structure. They now have, what's this, student government committee that's made up of parents, teachers, and some case one or two students. And I think they still feel that the schools are being run by parents and not by the people who are hired to run the school. See?
A lot of would you say the white parents? Or?
Well, I would specifically say that because they are in the majority. They feel that we elected school board members to operate the public schools, and yet the schools are run by parents. And the principals that we select to operate the schools, who train to be administrators, are pawns of the parents, of the student government committee. They can be overruled, in other words. And if we look at the principal as being the head of each school, and they ought to be able to determine what happens in that school. But it's no longer possible that it be happening in that school.
You think that the parents are telling the principal that?
Oh, I'm sure they are. That was a feeling.
You had mentioned the lack of understanding of the white teacher for the black student. If I interpreted what you said correctly, could you expand on that?
Well, let's see. How can I expand on that particular thing? You have a group of white teachers who, to a great extent, grew up they can't adjust themselves to an integrated situation as well, because they've never had to face that. They know nothing about the hardships that black people have, and the problems that they have, and the problems they feel towards a white man or a white person. Therefore, they are not in tune with how a black person would react to certain statements that they might make, certain actions that they might take. They may feel that person is doing this because I'm black. Well, it may not be. It may be the truth, and it may not be. But they don't see the situation through the eyes of a black child, because they haven't faced those problems. See? Why are you late? Why are you out of school? You got to do this, you got to do that. You know? If you're going to pass my class. And then, you know, the marking schemes that the people have. You know, one time it was an idea that a certain segment, because of the way they mark, a certain segment of the population of the class is going to fail regardless of what they do because of this marking scheme.
Did they call on the black students the way they called on the white students when they asked questions in class?
That I can't. I can only speak from the standpoint of my classroom. every child had an opportunity to participate in my classes, and I encouraged them to do that. One thing I said to a student, now if you come into my classroom and you listen and you pay attention, I will guarantee that you will learn one new thing every day that you didn't know before you walked in here. I said, just think about this. If you learn one thing every day, and we have school 180 days a year, look how smarter you would be. Look how smarter you would be this year, at the end of this year, than you were last year. You use various techniques and to motivate youngsters to participate so they want to. It's interesting. You wonder sometimes why students select certain teachers over other teachers. And that is strictly because of that teacher's ability to motivate that child, that make that subject so interesting that they want to be in every class that that teacher has. And there's a rush at registration time to get in Miss So-and-so class or Mr. So-and-so class. Why? Wonder if they ever asked that question. Why? One of my main concerns when I was assistant principal at high school, I was one of the most, I would consider myself an unorthodox, evaluator, because we had to evaluate teachers' performance. Most people who go in to evaluate a teacher sit in the back of the room. Not me. I always sit at the teacher's desk. Now, I'm not going to question that teacher's ability as far as academics are concerned. She's graduated from college. They've passed the national teacher's exam. They've been hired, interviewed by the superintendent or by somebody, and they have a good record of teaching. But the question is, how well can they get across to those students? And I look the student in the face. I watch the student's action. I can tell from the student's action how good a teacher that is. I don't have to look at her or him. But if I'm sitting in the back of the room, I can't see that student. I'm looking at the back of their head. They may be sitting straight up asleep. Or they may be looking all around, not paying attention to what she's saying. That person may not have any effect whatsoever on that student in their classroom. And my philosophy has always been, it was when I came here in 1942, to make a difference in the lives of the young people that I taught.
And you did.
And every teacher, a good teacher, and I evaluate teachers on the basis of how well I feel that they are making a difference in the lives of young people. So, to a great extent, that was a problem with integration. You had teachers, both black and white, as far as I'm concerned, who did not have as a part of their teaching skills to make a difference. They were too concerned with academics. Too concerned with. An example, every math teacher, if you were teaching Algebra 1 in high school, and if you had three sections, there was a feeling that every math teacher should be at the same point in that book every day. Now, what does that say to me? You get it or you don't get it. I'm going to cover this book. I'll tell you why I had that. I had a young man when I was at Lincoln Mr. McDougall asked me to come in because the teacher was out and just put assignment on the board and just monitored during that period because I was at a very free period. I came in, put the assignment on the board, teacher left with beautiful plans, but no motivating activities. See, when I was in college, my critic teacher required every lesson plan that you write must have some motivating activities in it. If it didn't have some in there, he'd turn it back to you, and it's not acceptable. But I went in his classroom and I put the assignment on the board, and I was just walking around looking at the students, you know, monitoring them. And one young man was sitting in the back of the room. He wasn't doing anything, so I asked him, I said, "What's wrong?" He said, I don't understand what I'm to do. So you know how chairs are in the classroom. I pulled a chair beside him and I went over that assignment and explained to him, like I would explain it to him if I were the teacher. He looked at me and said, nobody ever explained it to me like that. Because I explained it different than what the teacher had explained. The same subject. But my method of explaining to students and her method of explaining to students was so different. I was given an individualized instruction. When we talk about individualized instruction, that young man ended up in a few years with his own building company in Maryland. The state of North Carolina hired him